Published to coincide with the 150th anniversary of the landmark battle this summer, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, is a new account from acclaimed historian and director of Civil War Studies at Gettysburg College, Alan Guelzo. Guelzo shows us the face, sights, and sounds of combat, the stone walls and gunpowder clouds of Pickett's charge, the reason that the Army of Northern Virginia could be smelled before it could be seen, the march of thousands of men from the banks of the Rappahannock in Virginia to the Pennsylvania Hills. What emerges is an untold story from the personal politics roiling the Union and Confederate officer ranks to the peculiar character of artillery units. Alan Guelzo is the Henry Luce Professor of the Civil War Era and the author of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, and Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, both winners of the Lincoln Prize. It's a great pleasure to welcome Alan Guelzo to the program. Thank you very much for being back. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Joe.
What brought you to take a look at Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, and to really write such an in-depth account?
Well, part of it is a little bit like what Mallory told the New York papers when they asked him why he was trying to climb Everest. That was because it was there, he said. And being here in Gettysburg, you're surrounded by all the remnants of the battle, all the memories of the battle, all the markers of the battle. So that is the kind of thing that suggests itself. But also, there's a much larger and more compelling reason, and that is we know a lot more today than we knew even 15 years ago about what happened at Gettysburg and how we can get that into focus, because there's so many different stories which have lain buried in archives or been unexamined for so long. I think the most important one concerns the role that politics plays in the Battle of Gettysburg. We don't often think of politics as having much to do with battles or military affairs. That's a matter for professional soldiers to iron out. And in the American tradition, we always subordinate military decision-making to the civilian authorities. But in the Civil War, it's a very different story. The Civil War is a very political war to start with. And it's not merely a matter of North versus South, of Union versus Confederate. Even the Union and the Confederacy themselves were internally very divided over the kind of war that they were fighting, or whether they even wanted to be fighting it at all. And both armies that come here to Gettysburg are badly divided in terms of political allegiances, and quite frequently those political divisions will impinge on the military decision-making that happens here at Gettysburg. Telling that story maybe is the most important aspect of this battle, which has never really been examined.
You make the case in the book that, just looking at the case of George Gordon Meade commanding the Union Army at Gettysburg, that politically motivated decisions nearly cost him the battle.
Well, one in particular. He was very much a conservative, Philadelphia-born Democrat, and therefore had very little sympathy with Abraham Lincoln's Republican administration or with the radical Republican interest in emancipation. After all, Meade himself, two of his sisters had married Southerners, lived in the South. One of his nephews had been killed on the other side of the Battle of Chancellorsville just 2 months before. So his own identification with the war effort is very, very chilly. And that means that when he takes command of the Army of the Potomac, and he finds that he has subordinate officers like Dan Sickles of New York, who are 180 degrees politically from where Meade is oriented, he tends to shove them to the sidelines. And on July 2nd, the second day of the battle, Meade shoved Dan Sickles and his 3rd Infantry Corps all the way to the left side of the terrain, of the battlefield, and paid no attention whatsoever to Sickles' protest that there were Confederate infantry massing in the woods opposite him, ready to launch an attack. Meade simply blindsided him completely. And then, when the Confederate attack, in fact, materialized, Meade was taken entirely by surprise by this attack. This attack on July 2nd very nearly overran Meade's army completely. So based on personal and political considerations like that, Meade almost lost his own battle for himself by making a decision that really emerges out of political resentments.
When you look at Meade and you look at Robert E. Lee, the personalities were so influential here, weren't they?
Well, in the 19th century, they tend to be, because although the armies themselves are very, very big affairs, the Confederate Army has about 85,000 soldiers in its ranks at Gettysburg, the Union Army about 95,000. Nevertheless, individual character, individual decision-making is very much to the fore, and the personalities, the commanders, impress themselves on the armies and make a tremendous difference in the kinds of actions that are taken at Gettysburg.
So talk a little bit about, we mentioned Meade, but talk a little bit about the personalities, and beginning with Robert E. Lee.
Robert E. Lee is often described as the marble man. He is a man utterly devoted to duty, to his home state of Virginia, to his family. He is the ultimate embodiment of this noble, pure, restrained, gentlemanly Southern cavalier. Or at least that is the image that he works very, very hard to cultivate. Underneath that unruffled, unmottled image, there existed a man of really volcanic, aggressive impulses. People who knew Lee very well often had to try to explain him to others. People on the outside, standing on the sidelines, looked at Lee and they said, well, he's a very chilly, he's a very remote person. He doesn't really seem to be the kind of get-in-there-and-brawl kind of general. And the reply would come, oh, you do not know Robert E. Lee. He is a man of the most aggressive impulses. And all through the war, Robert E. Lee would take the offensive. He would go on the offensive. He would take the aggressive initiative as often as he possibly could. He would attack, he would attack, he would attack. It's a very curious conjunction to see. You know, here on the exterior is a man who never seems to work up a sweat, who always seems to be perfectly in control of himself, serene and aristocratic. And his men adore him. The ordinary soldiers of the Army of Northern Virginia idolized Lee. And yet those who were very close to Lee, like his staff, knew that Lee could be temperamental, unpredictable, demanding, and occasionally ungrateful. One of his military secretaries said that he couldn't recollect an occasion in which Robert E. Lee ever thanked him for anything that he did. So what an interesting composite Robert E. Lee is. The public face of the man, but then also this private face. And that private face is the private face of a man who wants to strike at his enemy, strike hard, strike direct, and as often as he possibly can. The downside, of course, is that that's going to bleed his army white.
Well, as you point out in the book, there's a fine line between his aggressiveness and recklessness.
Yes, because aggressiveness is what we tend to say when someone succeeds. When they fail, then we call it recklessness, because, of course, nothing succeeds like success. In the case of Robert E. Lee, people often point to the apex of the Battle of Gettysburg, which is Pickett's charge on the 3rd of July, 1863. And people look at that and they shake their heads and they say, well, my goodness, was that really an intelligent decision? Because what this amounts to is sending something like 12 or 13,000 Confederate infantry straight across almost a mile of open, unprotected ground, straight at Union defending infantry and artillery. And people say this really didn't have a chance of succeeding. Even one of Lee's subordinates protested the attack and said, there's no way that any 13,000 or 14,000 men I know could take a position like that. Yet Lee insists on it. Had he somehow become unhinged in the Pennsylvania sunlight, too much of that July summer sun? Well, no, of course not. The fact is that Lee had very carefully calculated what was going to happen with Pickett's charge. And he had every good reason to assume that it was going to succeed, largely because at that point in the battle, of the seven infantry corps that composed the Union Army, the Army of the Potomac, five of them were effectively out of commission from the previous 2 days of the battle. So Lee really had a situation where he had the Union Army on the ropes and really believed all he had to do was come driving in and deliver one great big knockdown punch, and that would end the battle. And it almost succeeded. It really did come within an ace of success. The Confederates almost punched their way through. And as the Duke of Wellington said about Waterloo, it was a close-run thing.
Alan Guelzo is our guest. We're talking about his new book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. It is published by Knopf. And we talked about George Gordon Meade, but one of the things that I found fascinating about his story is that he was appointed to command only 3 days before the battle.
Yes, and how do you like that for organizational talents? That's going to strain any organizational talent right to the utmost. When Meade is put in command of the army, he doesn't really even know where the various parts of the army are at that moment. And he's got 3 days to pull this together. He's going to have to use the staff that presently exists. He really doesn't have time to put his own people in place. And he also has to now assume command over seven individuals who previously had been his peers. So he had just suddenly found himself promoted to people who were not necessarily going to look upon him as the automatic commander of the army. And he has to impose his will on this. And that is a tough job for anybody. I don't care whether it's Lee Iacocca or Jack Welch or any of the great moguls of corporate leadership. That's a challenge that would make anyone blanch. The curious thing is that Meade brings to it a certain reluctance. As it was, George Meade had never wanted to be a professional soldier. He only went to West Point because his father had gone bankrupt and died, and that ended the family's financial stability. So he goes to West Point basically to get a free education as an engineer and actually does serve very briefly in the Army, gets out, opens up his private engineering practice, really doesn't do all that well in it, goes back into the Army and has a career of some 15, 20 years that is, it's reasonably competent, but it's certainly nothing that you would write a biography about. When the war breaks out, because he does have at least professional experience, he is given a general's commission, and he really becomes something of a protege of the man who created the Army of the Potomac, and that was General George McClellan. McClellan, the arch-Democrat and inevitably the great critic of Abraham Lincoln, in fact runs against Lincoln for president in 1864. For George Meade suddenly to be handed the ticket to command this army is a real surprise to him and to many other people. But he only gets that ticket in large measure because no one else by that point really wants the job of commanding the Army of the Potomac. The Army had met with so many defeats at the hands of the Confederates, and commanding the Army had become such a political cockpit that many of the other officers, senior officers in the Army, had actually turned down approaches by Abraham Lincoln for them to take command of the Army. Meade only takes command because, well, Lincoln doesn't ask him. Lincoln orders him to take command of the Army. And so 3 days before the battle, suddenly there is George Gordon Meade with no warning, and suddenly he's in the driver's seat, and he has to make this machinery work.
You do write in the book that few people understood that the principal figure in making the Gettysburg battle happen in the way it did was a man who wasn't even there for most of the 3 days, and that was John Reynolds. Tell us a little bit about John Reynolds and how he came to play such a key role.
John Fulton Reynolds is one of the most unappreciated characters in the story of Gettysburg, and there's a very plain reason for that, and that is that he's killed right at the outset of the battle. But it was really Reynolds' decisions that made the battle happen, where it did, when it did, and how it did. Reynolds was a major general in the Army of the Potomac. He commanded the First Corps of the Army of the Potomac. And throughout the Army, he was very well respected, not very colorful, but still very well respected for good judgment and for staying out of the political furies. When Meade takes command of the Army of the Potomac, that, of course, makes him the superior to Reynolds. Meade's first instinct was to create a defensive barrier to protect Baltimore and Washington from Lee's invasion of Pennsylvania. And Meade's plan, therefore, was to draw the Army of the Potomac behind Pipe Creek, which runs across northern Maryland. Reynolds looked at that and said, no, that's not really a particularly good idea, because if we go on the defensive and plant ourselves at Pipe Creek, then that's going to allow Lee to run rampant through central Pennsylvania. And Reynolds, of course, himself was from central Pennsylvania. His family was from Lancaster and went all the way back into the 18th century. They owned lots of property in Lancaster. And Reynolds expressed a certain degree of apprehension that Meade was simply going to allow Lee to have a free hand running through Pennsylvania, which Reynolds was simply not in agreement with. Reynolds, therefore, bolts ahead of the rest of the army. He understands that the Confederates are concentrating near Gettysburg, and so he, on very much his own initiative, throws the First Corps, the Third Corps, and the 11th Corps, those three units of the Army of the Potomac, forward to grapple with the Confederates at Gettysburg in order to keep them from securing control of the town, and especially of the critical heights just south of the town. So it's Reynolds who really precipitates the battle, who springs the trap prematurely, so to speak. And in one of his last messages back to Meade, he says, I understand, I comprehend that you really did not want to fight here, but I've had to do this on my own authority and on the basis of my own judgment. And in a way, Reynolds forces Meade's hand by committing something a little bit less than half of the Army of the Potomac to fighting at Gettysburg. And eventually Meade has to go along with it and draw the rest of the army up to Gettysburg. By the time he arrives there, however, Reynolds has been killed in the early fighting by a Confederate skirmisher. And so Reynolds himself is not there to give any kind of oversight or control to the battle. But in the long run, when you look back at it, the reason the battle is fought there and fought on July 1st is because of John Reynolds' decision to make it happen there instead of at Pipe Creek.
One of the fascinating aspects of the book and the story that you tell, I think, is how the land itself was so crucial to how the battle played out. The geography really made the battle.
Well, one of the advantages of living in Gettysburg is that you live with the terrain itself. You understand that this is the ground under your feet, and you have some sense day by day, walking around, driving around, of how the land rises and falls. And it does. It's not a flat football field on which you are going to work out various plays as though that was the way a battle happened. The terrain at Gettysburg is something like a rumpled tablecloth, if you can imagine this. Between the Susquehanna River and the beginning of the Appalachian Mountains, what you get is this series of very gentle waves, gentle folds in the ground, slowly flattening out toward the Susquehanna. And these folds are the ridge lines that run north and south throughout the entire south-central region. The battle is really fought out on those ridge lines. Both armies occupy ridge lines, and those ridge lines are what dictate where you're going to move, where you're going to position troops. But there's another feature of the terrain that I found very peculiar, too, and this emerged not so much from observing it here as it did from the accounts of the soldiers themselves, and this especially Confederate soldiers. Because when Confederate soldiers moved up into Pennsylvania in the middle of June and late June, 1863, they remarked in their diaries and their letters home about how different Pennsylvania looked from their southern homes, especially from Virginia, where about a quarter of the Army of Northern Virginia had been drawn. One thing they noticed was how beautiful and lush and untouched it was. The war had not been fought on the doorsteps of Pennsylvanians the way it had been on the doorsteps of Virginians. So they enjoyed the prospect of being able to live off land like that. But another thing which impressed itself on them were the miles upon miles of fences. Now, you and I might not notice fences right off the top of our heads, but in an agricultural economy, fences are very, very important. That's what protects your land, marks your boundaries, keeps your animals, your cattle, within boundaries. And these Confederate soldiers were just awed by the mileage of fences, because back in the South, what they were used to were these large 500-acre plantation spreads. The soils of the Upper South were much poorer, and therefore you had to have larger farms in order to make them productive. In Pennsylvania, you could have a highly productive farm with just 50 acres because the soil was so rich. Therefore, you have smaller holdings, much more fences, and much more in the way of fences. Another thing which enters into it, too, is that those large southern farms are being worked by slaves. You need slave labor to work farms of that size. Whereas in Pennsylvania is a free state. You don't have slave labor. Farmers do their own work themselves, and therefore they really can't have terribly large farm spreads. So again, small acreage, lots of fences to define and protect it. Now, why is that important? Because when the Confederates come up here to fight, what they're constantly having to do is to tear down fences. Now, you might not think that's too important, but in the middle of a battle, fences are major obstacles. And especially for Pickett's charge, the two fences that lined either side of the Emmitsburg Road, which is the road that runs right parallel to the Union defending line, these were big plank and slab fences that were very difficult to get over. That disrupts attacking formations, makes it very hard to keep up the momentum of attacking infantry. Every Confederate account that we have surviving from Pickett's charge talks about the difficulty of getting over those fences. So in a real sense, it was the terrain, it was the way the land lay, and the way it was marked off for those fences, that really makes such a big difference in the fighting. And in the largest sense, it was that difference between the fences of a free state and the lack of fences in a slave state that tripped up these Confederate soldiers. In a way, the fences of a free state were fighting on the side of the Union, and the Confederates found them to be a serious obstacle.
It is a marvelous account. The name of the book is Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. The book is published by Knopf. Alan Guelzo, I thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us this morning.
You're very welcome, Joe. What a pleasure.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.